everyone, and welcome to another episode of Australian Politics Live, the podcast. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and this week we're back to neoliberalism. Is it dead? I have two guests this week for a very lively conversation coming up. Ed Balls, who is a former Labor parliamentarian from the UK, and I believe after his political life in the UK, he had a bit of a star turn on the Strictly Come Dancing show, but that's a by the by. Over sitting across from him is Wayne Swan, who of course was the Labor treasurer at the time of the global financial crisis. I've brought these two gentlemen into the pod cover this week because they're having a series of public events basically over the next 2 weeks or so, talking about the impact of the global financial crisis, how it's reshaped economic policy thinking in the centre-left right around the world. So for the next 20 minutes or so, we're going to chew the fat on where centre-left political parties are up to in terms of their economic thinking. We're going to think about neoliberalism. We're going to think about trade unions. We're going to think about wage stagnation, the whole kit and caboodle. It's coming up. Hope you enjoy it. So, Ed Balls, Wayne Swan, thank you so much for joining Australian Politics Live.
Good to be with you.
Now, let's just start with the easy question. Neoliberalism, is it over? Ed?
I think it's dead, but I'm not sure whether everybody's quite worked that out yet. Sometimes when you are listening to some politicians on the right, but also some people in the business community, it's almost as though they think if we just wait a little bit longer, we can go back to the way things were. But I think the reality is that a world in which you could say markets are always right, smaller government is always better, and if we just wait and stand back, somehow the wealth is going to trickle down to everybody and everybody will be happy. I mean, those days are gone, if they ever existed, I have to say, unless we find a way to deliver stability, growth, but also fairness and make sure that prosperity is really properly shared, then we're not going to have the kind of stable government, international cooperation. We'll see the kind of populism we've seen erupting in America and other parts of the world. And neoliberalism can't solve that problem, which is why we need new solutions.
Okay, well, picking up on that point, what is the role for government post-global financial crisis? If we accept that neoliberalism is not the answer anymore and that the public are not copying that as the answer, then what is the role for a contemporary government?
Well, it's funny, you know, because the Business Council of Australia hasn't got that message yet, but we do need to have that discussion here. We need to have it with the business community and we need to have it with the wider community. I think what it may mean is a more forceful role for government in economic affairs, you know, a stronger commitment to what we used to call the mixed economy, where the government had a much stronger role in writing the rules of the road. There's no question that the power of big money, and particularly big corporate money, is wielding a better stick in our political system, and that the monopolies and large institutions perhaps need different rules to function within. So one of the things we're going to concentrate in this project that Ed and I are working on is what are some of the new rules for the road in terms of corporate governance, for example, how boards are selected, I think is a very important part of this equation. We've got to have a look at not just the macroeconomic settings, because I think there'll be a bigger role for the state there. It doesn't mean bottomless deficits or anything like that, but it certainly does mean government working with the private sector to be an investor in both physical and human capital. That's certainly one thing that I think is going to happen.
The thing is, though, if you go back to Adam Smith, the famous economist over a couple of hundred years ago, he warned then of the danger of market economies becoming monopolistic and corrupt unless there's the right kind of government rules of the game. In the 50s, 60s, we saw the kind of industrial policy partnering government and business in Germany's growth, in America's growth. In the 1980s, you saw a partnership between a Labour government and business in the Accord succeeding with rising wages. Those were never periods of neoliberalism. I don't think there's ever been a phase where neoliberalism has worked. I think you've always needed that right balance of the market economy, but government playing its proper role to make sure you take a long-term view and stop monopolisation. And the idea that somehow free markets and neoliberalism meaning government out of the way, that's quite a new idea. I don't think it was ever a good idea, and I don't think it's a solution to the 21st century problems in the world.
But then there is a problem, though, is there not, for centre-left political parties, that that you've got to position yourself somewhere along the spectrum, what you might call the electable spectrum. A figure like Bernie Sanders galvanised thought, opinion, galvanised young people in the United States, couldn't win the Democratic nomination. Jeremy Corbyn in the UK performed well above everybody's expectations in galvanising, again, young people across the board, people who responded to his slogan, what was it, for the many, or who really rallied to that point of view. But neither of those politicians, centre-left politicians, were successful. Were they? So where do you draw the line?
Well, I think you could argue that Sanders may well have been successful in the US. I think you can very much argue that Hillary Clinton did not take a muscular enough economic program for the future into that election. And I think that's the reason she was beaten in the general election. But she did manage to win the primary. And I think there needs to be in the United States a much thorough discussion about all of that. But I don't see the two as being incompatible. I think people are now beginning to understand, after they see in this country, for example, the sort of behaviour we've seen from the Commonwealth Bank, BHP and so on, that there needs to be a stronger role for government. Now, that doesn't necessarily inevitably mean higher taxation and authoritarian solutions, but I think it does demand a much greater role for government, working cooperatively, not just with the private sector, but with the community more generally. Mm-hmm.
I think one place, though, where I would be quite sceptical about Sanders and Corbyn is that they both talk about one nation solutions. They talk about an America first policy, quite sceptical about trade. That was the Sanders view. Jeremy Corbyn has always been a one nation socialist, very sceptical about Britain's membership of the European Union. Now, there's no doubt the international rules of the game need to change, but unless you have open trade rather than closed borders, economies like Britain and Australia aren't going to grow and flourish. And unless we have international cooperation, we're not going to solve the problem of multinational companies not paying their fair share of tax or climate change. If we shut ourselves off from the world, and America does too, we will see more poverty for longer periods of time in developing countries like China, India and other emerging market economies. So I think that the non-neoliberal solution can't be a swing to nationalism. It's got to be about the right kind of international cooperation on the macroeconomy, on trade and tax, on the environment, combined with national policies, as Wayne said, for growth and for tackling inequality, where governments take a lead. And I don't think the go it alone, shut yourself off from the world strategy is going to work. And when I hear Bernie Sanders and his scepticism about trade with the rest of the world and trade agreements, I think you hear echoes of that in Corbyn as well. I don't think that's the right answer to the failure of neoliberalism either.
Well then, but you've got to go back and rebuild that community consensus though, don't you? Because the sort of there has been this rise of the new nationalism, nativism, populism. Trump sort of set this isolationist tone. That tone has bled across into left-wing populism as well. So how do you create a constituency for you know, the architecture of neoliberalism in the sense of open markets, internationalism, globalisation?
Well, in the United States, large sections of the middle class were simply left behind for the last 30 years, and they were losers from a combination of globalism, but they were particularly losers because they had governments with domestic policies which didn't put in place the support they needed for the well-paid jobs they were promised. And that's why the backlash has happened. It hasn't just happened because there's been globalisation or technological change. It has been deficient domestic policy response from government that has failed to put in place the promised benefits that were said to have flowed from the changes that came with trade agreements. We're a great trading nation. We need to have trade agreements which are in our national interest. But I, for example, don't support investor-state dispute settlement clauses in trading agreements. And indeed, in our government, we took a decision not to sign them. So trade must happen under a set of rules which are balanced and which deliver for people domestically as well, along with domestic policy.
Do you have that same view on ISDS clauses there?
Well, I do think, you know, that to go to the bigger point first, the stagnation of wages you saw in America for middle income earners, but you've seen it in Britain the last 15 years. You see some signs of it in the last couple of years in Australia as well, this is very problematic, because if people don't feel as though they're getting better off, if they work hard and play by the rules, and they see people on the highest income shooting ahead, then they can sometimes be quite open to people coming along with a simple solution, saying, let's just cut ourselves off from that economic system. And that isn't going to work. What you've got to have is policies, one for growth. That means rejecting austerity. It doesn't mean embracing fiscal profligacy. The interesting thing about Wayne's time as a finance minister is he used stimulus to avoid recession, but within the context of being tough about the long-term fiscal position without being, you know, and not being imprudent. That's really important. And it's very interesting to me to see now the OECD and the IMF this year both telling Australia, if the economy slows down this year, be ready to use fiscal policy to support growth.
Right.
But they weren't saying that 5 years ago.
No,
they
won't. Because the IMF is saying that we have fiscal room for further fiscal stimulus. And they're saying you're crazy because you're not actually investing when interest rates are low in critical economic infrastructure for the long term. Exactly. So the IMF is arguing that there needs to be strong public investment with borrowed money in economic infrastructure, which will deliver more for the country in the long term than other steps the government might take to slash the budget elsewhere. It'll do better for the economy in the long term to borrow for public infrastructure investment than to take the axe to critical parts of the budget.
Which says to me that the IMF has also realised that the neoliberal view that cutting the deficit faster is always good, making the government smaller is always good, and that fiscal activism in recessions is a bad idea. I think the IMF has worked out that's
there's no
didn't
question
work.
That there's been a 180 degree turn at the IMF, the OECD, and all the other organisations when it comes to fiscal policy, which is what needs to be the primary means of lifting demand in the economy to deliver the jobs at the pay rates we desire.
But we still can't, though, lose sight of, and both of you have addressed it, so I'm not saying that you're avoiding it, but the reason Wayne Swan was able to launch a Keynesian response in Australia and a substantial response by way of the stimulus spend was that we did have that room to move in the budget. We did. And this is the conundrum. I don't know. Look, both of you, shout me down. I know you will.
Deficits are substantially higher now, and the IMF is still saying they've got that room. Exactly. So that we weren't able to do it just because there was a surplus. We were able to do it because over a long period of time, we had invested in our economy the right way and delivered the long-term economic strength. It's not so much where you are at a particular point in time. It's where you've been and where you're going.
No. All of that's right. I'm not taking issue with that, Wayne, who's smiling at me like the Cheshire Cat at this point in time. Not taking issue with that. And when it comes to budgets, everything's relative, right? Australia's budgetary position is a lot better than a lot of other developed economies. Obviously, self-evidently. Still a problem, though.
Of course it is.
When you are a centre-left government, when you are styling yourself post-global financial crisis as a more activist government, i.e. a government that invests in things, be it productive infrastructure, be it social spending, be it whatever you want to invest in, money's got to come from somewhere. Where does it come from, guys?
But the lesson I draw from the success of Labour in Australia in the 80s into the 90s, Wayne's time as finance minister, the lesson I draw as well from Labour's experience in government after 1997 is that on the one hand, you've got to be pro-growth. Keeping the economy growing is the best way to get your debt down, to make people better off, actually to tackle poverty as well. And if you're a left-of-centre government, of course you've got to be pro-growth. But that means that you've also got to say that we need to keep inflation low, that we need to take tough decisions in the medium term for the budget. If you come along and say, we don't care about inflation, we'll spend all the money we can, profligacy rules, voters in those circumstances turn around and say, well, we don't trust you. Mm. Whereas if they trust you, then if the economy goes into recession, you can use that kind of fiscal activism to keep the economy growing. And it's that balance. On the one hand, whatever happens, cut spending, the neoliberal view, that's bad.
That's all.
But
that's
the hard left view, which is we don't have to worry about any of these rules of the game, we can just spend, people won't trust that because they know it's not going to work. And it's that balance you've got to achieve.
So it's the old saying, Keynesian on the way down, Keynesian on the way up.
Yes, yeah. No, sure. Okay, well, both of you have very tantalisingly said that the centre-left needs a growth agenda. What is it?
Well, I think it's not turning away from trading with other countries, but finding ways to make that trade fairer in terms of tax, in terms of, I think we need to have a discussion about whether we need to have basic labour standards in international trade discussions. Not saying they have to be the same standards, but it's really hard to have fair trade with big emerging market economies if they are breaking the rules in terms of what they signed up to on climate change or on child labour. I think it's really important to look at your infrastructure, and that can be education, but also the physical infrastructure, because if you don't invest in those things, yeah, your economies become weaker. And I think the third thing is that that if you are locking lots of people outside of prosperity because they can't get into the labour market and work, then that's a drain on the growth as well as a source of inequality.
Well, for, and well, and most obviously, we need the global economy to grow, particularly in this country. So we've got a big stake in the international arrangements that, that we mentioned before. So we should be out there very strongly pushing for a decent set of international arrangements through the G20, particularly when it comes to issues such as company tax, because we need revenue bases and we can't afford to have the holes punched in our revenue bases that we need to fund the health and education that people want and the physical infrastructure. In this country, we shouldn't underestimate just how big an economy we are and how we can really have some clout in those international discussions and how we can work with our trading partners on decent trading agreements, which will deliver jobs and higher living standards for the future. But those living standards, as the IMF tells us, will be lifted more strongly if we grow more fairly. So that means investments in Medicare. It means progressive tax systems. It means a decent voice for labour. The combination of those things is what delivers the stronger growth over time. You have to have a productivity agenda, which means your education and training arrangements are good, and your tax arrangements have to be in sync with that as well.
What about, obviously, just with wages? We've talked a bit about wages stagnation, which is sort of a backdrop to all of these trends. And obviously the research shows us that collective bargaining obviously increases the wage outcomes of workers. So it's sort of, you know, there's your ad, join the union. But a lot of people are not joining unions in a modern service-oriented economy. They're just not, and they're probably not going to. So then again, conundrum for centre-left political parties who have had long institutional associations with trade unions and trade union movements. How do you conceptualise a labour market policy that is, in essence, pro-union with unions, but also post-union? For example, I think in the UK, you guys raised the minimum wage, did you not? And that had a tangible outcome on inequality. The whole bunch of people at the bottom end of the wages scale all of a sudden had more income. Have you got to look at ways outside trade union structures in order to deal with inequality?
Well, first of all, the minimum wage is very important. And one of the reasons we've been so much better for so longer is we've had a relatively high minimum wage. But that in itself is being torn down and eroded and having holes punched in it by profound technological change across a whole range of industries. Well, it's not just the robots, it's Uber, it's everything. Mm-hmm. There's a whole lot of change where traditional jobs don't exist. They've been outsourced. You've seen in the UK zero-hours contracts, these sorts of things. So there is a big challenge from a regulatory point of view as to how you establish the minimum standards for people who are doing particular jobs but may not be the traditional job. So that's a very big task for parties of the centre-left. But I strongly believe unless we can get stronger demand and get tighter labour markets, we're not going to see the wages move up as they should. At the moment, wages are deflated around the Western world because underemployment is chronic in many countries. And that's partially a function of the technological change that I was talking about before and the lack of regulatory control across a whole new range of work processes.
Give us a UK perspective on that, Ed.
Well, we've all seen stagnation of wages. We've also seen a decline in the coverage of trade unions in the workforce. I think, though, that squeeze on wages has happened in countries with greater role for trade unions and a smaller role. I think it's a big challenge for the trade union movement to reach out into the service sector, to the new private sector. In the UK, the trade union movement has become more concentrated on the public sector over a period of time. And a lot of the trends Wayne is talking about are happening outside the private sector. But look, I look at Australia and see the way in which government and trade unions over decades have talked about the kind of policies in the welfare state, in the minimum wage, which can make a real difference to the job and wage prospects of working people. And trade unions playing that positive, progressive role in the policy debate, I think, is really, really important. And we see that in the UK too.
But it's not just that. I mean, it's work of voice on boards too, I think. I mean, some of the corporate behaviour we see is takes place in a bubble. And I think we've got to have a look at some of the other examples around the world where, you know, we find a better way for trade unions and or working people or others to participate in those things.
Well, we talked about the IMF endorsing fiscal activism. In Britain, we had a Conservative Prime Minister, Theresa May, talking about there being worker representatives on company boards. And so maybe Theresa May has realised that the neoliberalism is in trouble as well as the IMF. Translating that into action has taken a very long time, though.
Yeah, conservatism was in trouble, I think.
Well, look, listeners can tell this is a great conversation. We could really go on for about 3 weeks, but sadly, this is all the time the gents have. So thank you very much for joining us, Wayne Swan, Ed Balls. Delightful.
Thank you very
pleasure.
Much.
Well, thank you so much for listening. We really do appreciate it. Remember, you can subscribe to the series and download us using your favourite podcast app, whatever that happens to be. If you are downloading us via iTunes, don't forget that rating or a review. It's very, very important. Thank you, as always, of course, to the marvellous Miles Martignoni, who is the producer of this podcast and the other Guardian Australia podcasts that you can find really in by searching for them in the same way as you search for us, Behind the Lines, and a new one coming pretty soon now called Common Ground, which we'll talk a little bit more about once that bus has left the station. So Parliament has been sitting, all kinds of stuff going on. It's been lively as anything, of course. We'll be back next week with updates. Keep you all posted. Until we all meet again, take care.